It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
It's Friday, March 29th, and they don't take crypto in the prison commissary. We start here. Sam Bankman-Fried is sentenced to 25 years behind bars.
It's one of the longest financial fraud sentences in history.
Why the judge decided to send a message to other digital scammers. The cleanup begins in Baltimore.
You can see the steel weighing down the bow of the ship.
But is it safe? Our team is out on the water. And Americans say they don't like their options, but they don't seem to want another one.
Joe Lieberman's last political crusade seems to be a bust.
Why groups recruiting third-party candidates are coming up short. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When we look back on this decade, the 2020s, we might remember it as a time when there was this really weird fad called cryptocurrency, this digital money that wasn't issued by a government, but rather by anyone who was convinced they could get people to mine and trade their product. We might be telling our grandkids, there were a million of these things, you wouldn't believe it. Or perhaps we'll look back at this time period as the start of when cryptocurrencies became the norm. Nothing weird about this at all. But one thing seems certain. We will look back and see the saga of Sam Bankman-Fried as an inflection point, as the moment that this nascent industry started taking responsibility, or perhaps the moment it all started falling apart. Yesterday, the young tech mogul who ran one of the world's preeminent cryptocurrency exchanges was sentenced for a fraud worth billions. ABC senior investigative correspondent Aaron Katursky was in court watching this. He is outside the courthouse right now. Aaron, what was the sentence?
Sam Bankman-Fried was sent to prison for 25 years, Brad, by a judge who said he committed a very serious crime and showed no remorse for it. And he was also ordered to forfeit $11 billion that he does not have, but that prosecutors could in theory use to try to compensate thousands of victims who, in some cases, lost all their money.
I really deeply wish that I had taken, like, a lot more responsibility for understanding what the details were.
Sam Bankman-Fried committed an $8 billion fraud. He took customer money from FTX, once the premier crypto exchange, you know, had the name on the arena in Miami, had Super Bowl ads. Bankman-Fried palled around with Bill Clinton and Giselle and Tom Brady and the like. And he used that $8 billion to prop up his privately controlled hedge fund, which was making a series of risky investments that turned out to be bad bets. One of the things that Bankman-Fried was able to do so effectively was portray himself as one of the good guys. He was up on Capitol Hill.
Is it reckless for crypto companies to get rich by selling Americans such a dangerous, risky product?
Thank you, Senator Brown, for the question. I think what this highlights is the need for federal oversight of the cryptocurrency industry.
He was using his political influence, thanks to the donations he had made to so many campaigns, to lobby for sensible regulation of the crypto industry. And so in many ways, it backed up what he was telling FTX customers, that their money was safe, that he was a reliable partner for them. And the judge said, Brad, that was all an act. He did not buy it and found that Bankman-Fried had deceived a lot of people.
Why such a long sentence? I mean, this was huge by financial crime standards, right?
It's one of the longest financial fraud sentences in history. It's not Bernie Madoff, 150 years, but it's more than, say, Elizabeth Holmes at, what, 11 years. And the judge said it reflected the seriousness of the crime, and it wasn't even what prosecutors wanted, 40 to 50 years. But it was far more than the 6 years the defense was seeking. And the judge said he had a real concern that Sam Bankman-Fried would commit another fraud if he was let out of prison too soon. He talked about his remarkable intelligence, and he said that there is a real risk that he had the conniving ability to commit some other kind of a crime. And the judge added pointedly, it is not a trivial risk.
Look, I screwed up. Like, I was CEO. I had a responsibility here. I had a responsibility to be on top of what was going on the exchange.
Bankman-Fried is quirky. In fact, his defense attorney said that he has a manner of speaking that, people find off-putting, but he's really at heart somebody who wants to do good. He's just kind of an awkward math nerd, is how his own attorneys described him. And prosecutors said they agreed. Sam Bankman-Fried was not a monster, but he was somebody who gambled for years with other people's money. And the judge agreed that there needed to be some kind of a message sent here, because he said this is a very serious crime. And Sam Bankman-Fried apologized, said he felt sorry that so many people were hurt, but the judge said he never heard a word of remorse. And that clearly rubbed the judge the wrong way.
Well, so then, what is the legacy of this fraud? Like, as you watched these court proceedings, did you get the sense that this will continue to impact the perception or even the business model of cryptocurrency?
Brad, this was one of the largest financial frauds in American history, and prosecutors wasted no time. It was a quick prosecution, and they were adamant that they wanted to send a message that even though crypto is kind of this newfangled currency, they're really prosecuting an old-fashioned crime like lying or cheating or stealing. And they said Bankman-Fried's fraud was a crime as old as time. And so I think part of the legacy here is that there are going to be new things that come around that criminals can exploit, and prosecutors are going to have to keep up.
It's one of those pieces of technology where you can imagine it being liberating for so many people. They go, aha, like this is not dependent on central banks or on foreign currency rates or anything. It's our own thing. Or you can also see dollar signs lighting up in people's eyes. And because everything here is moving so quickly, had these electronic exchanges in the Caribbean, you can imagine how quickly authorities want to clamp down on any potential fraud here. Aaron Katursky in New York. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, how do you start taking apart a bridge? We'll take you out on the water in Baltimore after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. When Baltimore officials decided to call off search and rescue efforts in the frigid waters under the remains of what used to be the Francis Scott Key Bridge, you'd think everyone could sort of stop and catch their breath. But that would ignore several urgent issues still unfolding at the crash site. For one, a usually bustling port is at a standstill, losing money every day for the local economy. And these huge shipping containers aren't all sitting nicely on top of their ship. Remember, when that bridge collapsed, many of them fell into the water, Some of those containers have released their contents into the bay. Let's go to Baltimore right now. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze has been out on the water getting a closer look at the wreckage. Elizabeth, what have you been seeing?
Hey, Brad, you know, this was really the first time we got to go up close to the site of the collapse. And I have to tell you, Brad, it was pretty striking to see the extent of this damage.
We're going to have a good 25-minute ride before we get out there.
We got on board a boat with the Army Corps of Engineers. They took some journalists out to basically see what is the start of a very long cleanup process. Immediately, as you're on this boat, kind of approaching the dolly ship, you just can see the scale of how massive the ship is.
Wow, we're getting very close.
A ship the size of a skyscraper, basically lodged in the middle of the river. And then this bridge just completely enclosed all around it with the steel jutting out in every direction.
You can see the steel weighing down the bow of the ship.
You could see the containers lined up all the way to the top. I mean, this is a massive undertaking to try to eventually clear that out.
Hey, and you had been the first one to say, hey, this is one of the biggest auto industry import areas in the country. Well, I mean, what are in those containers and are there hazardous materials now going into the water?
Right. So we asked the Army Corps of Engineers. We had a chance to speak with Lieutenant General Scott Spellman.
What is the first step in trying to get any of this cleared out?
Yeah, let me just walk through our general sequence of work. You can see on the vessel over there, we have a number of unstable containers.
And he talked about how it is going to be a very careful process to remove those containers from the ship itself. We know that a handful of them have hazardous materials, but we've learned that most of those materials are things like soaps and perfume. So right now, they're not an actual threat. But of course, they have to take every precaution.
That work will be ongoing. We're going to stabilize all of that work with our Coast Guard counterparts and certainly the shipping company.
Part of the issue, Brad, is not just kind of getting to those containers and getting them off so that the weight comes off of the ship. The issue is also getting into the water itself.
There's everything that we can do up here we can do in the daylight. We've got to be able to do the same thing 50 feet down. Incredible challenge.
And what we were told from General Spellman is that there were really only a couple of inches between the ship and the bottom of the river. And so what they have to do is just lift all of that weight up. But it's so hard for divers to get underneath because of how sharp this metal is, because of how dark and cold the waters are. This effort to kind of get at those containers is dangerous, and it is going to take some time.
Well, and it makes me think, Elizabeth, like if there's only a few inches for your average, you know, cargo container, that means that a bridge sitting in there is certainly not going to be traversable. Like all of that must need to come out. How intensive does this cleanup process become?
The short answer is it's intense. I mean, one part of the bridge that's on the bow right now, we were told weighs between 3,000 and 4,000 tons, which is the equivalent of about 8 million pounds. I mean, that's an unfathomable number.
This evening, we're bringing in one of the largest cranes on the eastern seaboard that can pick up 1,000 tons.
What they're going to have to do, we were told by General Spellman, is basically cut that piece of the bridge into four sections and then lift each section up because they can only carry about 1,000 tons at a time, which is already a huge number. So they're bringing in these massive cranes that'll go into the water. They'll lift those 1,000 tons part. They'll take them piece by piece out. And then throughout that whole process, they'll navigate the steel that's underneath.
On the bottom of this channel behind you, you can see a concrete tower, reinforced concrete tower. You don't see one on this side because it's in the water. That's all resting on the bottom.
There's such an urgent effort to get this port cleared so that ships can come back in and out because it is so vital to the economy of Baltimore and really to the U.S. as far as being a key port.
When we get the steel and concrete off the off of this channel, we will go with one-way traffic for vessels to come in.
The priority is to focus 24/7 on clearing it out so that they can try to reopen the port as soon as possible.
All right, Elizabeth Schulze, they're out on the water getting a sense of all this firsthand. Unbelievable. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
You probably heard that Joe Lieberman died this week. He was, of course, a Connecticut senator, a one-time presidential candidate, and he famously oscillated between being a Democrat and an independent. It might sound weird to some modern Democrats, but he was what you would call a kind of conservative Democrat.
Being a Democrat or a Republican is important. but it is nowhere near as important as being an American.
So it made a certain kind of sense when later in his life, Lieberman started a project called No Labels. His dream was to escape the two-party system and run a candidate who could challenge Republicans and Democrats. Well, this year, with the top two candidates suffering some of the worst approval ratings in history, you'd think this was the moment, and yet, ahead of a self-imposed deadline of April 1st, one of No Label's most sought-after candidates says he will not be running at all. ABC's political director Rick Klein is with me. Rick, this was former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie saying what? No thanks?
Yeah, he actually kicked the tires on this, Brad, and his team, I'm told, did some polling in more than a dozen states and ran the numbers and ran the math and ultimately concluded that first, they're not sure that No Labels can actually get on the ballot enough places to make a difference, and you'd have to win in so many states, 20, 25 states, that it's almost an impossible climb. And in their estimation, the only thing a No Labels candidate would do would be contribute to Donald Trump's election again, and that's exactly what Chris Christie said he wouldn't do when he decided to exit the Republican primary race right before the voting even started.
From the moment I got into the race, the decision that I made was really simple. I would rather lose by telling the truth than lie in order to win.
And it's so interesting, Brad, because it's not just Christie. I mean, in honor of baseball season, I can tick off the murderer's row of people that they thought, No Labels thought they might be able to lure into this race. People like Larry Hogan, the former governor of Maryland, and Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia. Nikki Haley was talked about as a dream candidate. They went on and on through the list. John Huntsman, the people like Jeff Duncan, the former lieutenant governor of Georgia, even said no. They weren't able to get anyone so far to sign on the dotted line and go with this. And that leaves No Labels without a candidate. And Joe Lieberman's last political crusade seems to be a bust.
Yeah, I was going to say, as we reflect on the life of Joe Lieberman, is the whole idea of escaping this two-party system, I mean, is that kind of done? Or is that just unique to this year?
Yeah, I think this is the mechanism that might be either off or ahead of its time. No Labels came in for just withering scrutiny as soon as it was launched from mostly Democrats who said this is an effort to, whether the organizers know it or want to or not, it's just going to help Donald Trump. The stakes are too high for something like this. And they tried to bring it down. That's complicated by the fact that No Labels was very secretive about some of its fundraising practices and even about some of its organizational efforts. So when candidates did think, well, maybe I'm intrigued by this, when they got closer, when they looked under the hood a bit, they said, wait a second, this maybe isn't everything we thought it would be. So it may be that Joe Lieberman is right in the longer term, but certainly in this cycle, No Labels does not appear to be delivering on the promise. As you say, Brad, you would think objectively that with so many people not happy with the two choices, they'd be wanting to look for this unity ticket, right? But they just haven't been able to find the actual humans to be part of that ticket.
Hey, and if we're talking about potential third party bids, can we talk for a moment about the former Democrat turned independent? Sounds familiar, but the presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He says he wants to get on the ballot in all 50 states. He says he's picked a running mate. I mean, is there a chance that now he does become kind of the most high-profile outsider running here?
No question. And look, he does come at it from a different direction than No Labels. No Labels has talked about if they're still able to pull it off, they would do a unity ticket, the Democrat and the Republican running together. Kennedy's a former Democrat. He picked a wealthy former Democratic donor in Nicole Shanahan to be his running mate this week.
You can understand why I gravitated to the Democratic Party. Because that was supposed to be the party of peace, the party of compassion. Many Democrats, we still believe in those ideals, but unfortunately, as an institution, it has lost its way.
But it's not clear at all that he would necessarily take more from a Democratic candidate. Keep in mind that while he's got one of the most famous names in Democratic political history, there are a lot of views that he has, particularly around vaccine skepticism and, frankly, some anti-science views that are more closely associated with libertarians, Republicans, the MAGA movement.
We declare independence from Wall Street, from big tech, from big pharma, from big ag, from the military contractors and their lobbyists.
So combine all of that with the fact that he really isn't on the ballot anywhere yet. He's only on one state, Utah. There's six or so others that his super PAC and people around him say they will get on. It's going to be an uphill climb for even to get to the starting line, to even be in enough places to make a difference. But I have no doubt that he's going to get a lot of attention. The sources that I've talked to in the Democratic Party, the firepower that they had aimed at No Labels is now squarely at Robert F. Kennedy Jr. They view him and his candidacy as a threat to Joe Biden and to Democratic chances.
I see. Like almost an excuse saying, I'll vote for this guy who says he's a Democrat, even though, as you've said, some of his claims aren't just anti-establishment. They've been at odds with basic facts. Rick Klein, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, it was supposed to be a breakthrough for tennis. Well, now there's no love lost here. One last thing is next. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And one last thing. Yesterday was baseball's opening day, which meant the return of home runs, hot dogs, and my favorite, complaining about bad calls.
That's not even close to a strike.
Well, one day soon they can challenge that or just have the robot call it.
The major leagues continue to flirt with the idea of automated umpiring, a world where a machine would tell a pitcher whether he just threw a ball or a strike.
We'll have to live with it for now. One ball, two strikes on Sano.
Well, if you think that would solve everything, check out what happened in the tennis world this week.
Wow.
This was a women's match at the Miami Open, which this year relied exclusively on electronic line calling. You know how in the old days you'd have human line judges stationed behind each line? They would raise their hand, calling in or out.
Hindrance.
In this match, Sorana Kirsteia serves the ball, and it clearly bounces wide. It's like a foot out of bounds. But instead of hearing an automated voice call out, the system declares it in.
That looked wide.
The other player stares up at the chair umpire like, are you sure about that? You gonna say anything? And here's what's bizarre. As the replay comes up on the screen showing the path of the ball, the computer simulation shows a ball mark that clearly doesn't belong to this serve. It's either a glitch or the computer's remembering an entirely different play.
I wonder if the technology's working here.
The chair umpire looks flummoxed, as if to say, what am I going to do? Say the line system is fallible? The whole match would be compromised. He upholds the bad call, and the entire momentum of the match shifts. That server comes from behind to win. It wasn't the only flub this week. Another match had to be halted because of a power outage, which this was a daytime match. A few years ago, this would not have mattered. But nowadays, there aren't even human line judges on site to serve as backups. You just have to wait until the system reboots itself. And all this serves as food for thought for, say, Major League Baseball. Tests in the minors have actually resulted in fewer arguments. We seem to implicitly trust machines more than our fellow humans. But if the calls are wrong, can you ever overrule them? After a few years of this, would you even have enough trained humans to do the job if you needed them later? After all, even at the highest levels, no one is faultless. Hey, a cool development I wanted to tell you about. The Gracies were announced yesterday. They honor some of the best women in journalism. Well, our own Michelle Franzen, you've heard her voice guest hosting here before. She won Outstanding News Anchor on the audio side. Kana Whitworth won for the ABC podcast King Road Killings. You should check out that pod if you haven't already. And one other milestone we're proud of, Start Here turned 6 years old this week. We're reading, we're spelling, we're so proud of this team, and I'm so thankful to so many of you that have been with us since day one. If you're just discovering the show, so glad you're here. Tell a friend. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Vika Aronson, Cameron Chertavian, Anthony Ali, Mara Milwaukee, Amira Williams, and welcome back Brenda Salinas-Baker from maternity leave. She's got the cutest baby with the almost enragingly full head of hair. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of podcast programming. I'm our managing editor. Laura Mayers, our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Tara Gimble, and Liz Alessi. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Sally Hawkins, Ryan Nantel, and our entire DC bureau, who's basically been living in Baltimore this week, bringing us the latest. I'm Brian Mielke. See you next week.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.